This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to a new episode of the Urban Political. Today, we're very excited to bring you the first episode in a new series on urban polycrisis. This series will explore the complex set of protracted, interconnected, and mutually reinforcing crises that disproportionately affect urban centers and urban populations, ranging from housing, democracy, transit, infrastructure, inequality, conflict, the environment, to health. That cities experience crises is nothing new, of course, and many urbanites experience crises as an everyday reality. Our series takes stock of these conditions and explores the idea of polycrisis as a means of capturing contemporary constellations of crisis. Our contributors explore both historical trajectories and contemporary manifestations and experiences of urban polycrisis in different geographic regions, from Colombia to South Africa to London, while highlighting the potential of insurgent practices that develop in response. In today's episode, Lindsay Blair Howe discusses strategies and tactics for acting in the current state of polycrisis with three guests: South African urbanist Thirishan Govinda, Colombian urbanist and educator Catalina Ortiz, and Swiss postdoctoral researcher and lecturer Katrin Hofer. Now, we hope you enjoy this episode and our new Urban Polycrisis series.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lindsay Blair Howe, and I'll be hosting the Urban Political podcast for you today. As part of the UPP series on the urban polycrisis, I'm here with my guests, Catalina Ortiz, Katrin Hofer, and Thirishan Govinda. We are here together because each of us, in our own unique way, is engaged with understanding what people do when they are confronted with the polycrisis, which often unfolds in the absence of the state's ability to fully provide access to and resources for an equitable urban life. Now, each of us has our own particular angle on how we think we should face the challenges the polycrisis presents, and so we are convening today to talk to you about how we define the polycrisis, how it relates to the various contexts in which we do our work, and the contributions that we want to and try to make despite, or sometimes perhaps even because of, these imperfect conditions. Because for us, this has long been a way of working and operating in the places we engage with, which are primarily located in locations across the Global South. Now, each of us come from a different place of origin, represent four of the seven continents. I was born in the United States in North America, Catalina come from Colombia in South America, Thirishan was born in South Africa, and Katrin in Switzerland, where I am also sitting today. And we've been feeling the weight of the polycrisis, all of us have, collectively in our work and also as individuals. And I believe there's an increasing presence of insurgent practices responding to these conditions, the world geopolitical conditions, the volatility we see in our cities. And that's sometimes worrisome because of the state's frequent inability to fully respond to these conditions. But it is just very simply the reality with which we are confronted, and we have to grapple with this, and we have to act anyways. So what we'll share today is not a blueprint for anything in particular. We're just drawing from experiences and observations, for example, from Southern Africa or South America, that we also feel in interesting ways are becoming increasingly prevalent in the global north too. We're recording the podcast this morning, what for me in Zurich is a crisp and cold but sunny winter day in mid-March 2025. I mean, and if we have to be honest about it, 2025 has got enough to kind of a rough start. I mean, last year we surpassed this critical 1.5 degree temperature benchmark of the pre-industrial era. The climate emergency is in full throttle here. Some particular highlights of our new world order in the Trump 2.0 era include world leaders wielding chainsaws on stages. We even have a South African behind the scenes in the White House. And I'm all for Make America African again, but while the rest of them sit there plotting their escape from Mars and their perfect new world, the rest of us are stuck here trying to face reality as we find it. So what can we do? How do we respond to the urban polycrisis? And can we perhaps even still find moments of hope and joy in all of this? This and more is what we want to discuss with you today on the Urban Political Podcast. I'd now like to introduce our guests today. Well, hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here today. First, we have Professor Catalina Ortiz, a Colombian urbanist and educator very passionate about spatial justice. She joined the Bartlett Development Planning Unit at University College London in 2015 and assumed directorship of the UCL Urban Lab in 2024. Catalina's professional experience spans over 2 decades of teaching, research, and consultancy linked to urban projects and spatial planning issues. So you've also taught and lectured extensively across many institutions based in Europe and Latin America. Catalina, where are you coming to us from today?
So hi, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here. Today, I'm joining you from North London. It's still a beautiful, very cold day. And I'm here sitting in a coffee place trying to see from the window the urban life in this very hectic city. I'm very happy to be with you.
Great. And so the podcast listeners, you've been with the Urban Political Podcast before, but some of them may not know you yet. So what's something that we wouldn't know about you from reading your profile on the UCL website? Share a fun fact with us.
Well, the reality is I'm an aspiring storyteller and a salsa dancer. And that is the thing that I feel makes me happy. I like to do collage. And that is also a space of sanity and creative practice that, you know, put me in a very different mood. And I think it's a sacred space for me to do and respect kind of that creative space.
A collage is a sacred space. I love the idea of that. And also of salsa dancing. We said we wanted to try to find some moments of hope and joy. And I think dance and music and art are very much some of these things. Catalina, thank you so much. Next, we have Thureshan Govender, or Thresh for short. He's an African urbanist and an independent director at the Sustainable Livelihoods Foundation, as well as the founder of UrbanWorks Architecture and Design. And you've also been associated with various institutions across the years, including the African Futures Institute and University of the Witwatersrand currently. Thresh, you've also worked extensively in townships and informal settlements as your co-authored book, Township Economies, People, Spaces, and Practices explores. And you've taught design at numerous universities, including previously the ETH Zurich with Heinrich Wolf and the inaugural Venice Biennale College with Leslie Loca. Where do we find you this morning?
Hi, Lindsay. Lovely to be with you and your guests today, and also to your fellow listeners. I'm from Johannesburg, and I'd just like to make an excuse in advance for the sudden noises of like little dinosaurs. Those are haridas, which helps give you some evidence of my location as we go on. So I'm in my studio at the moment in Johannesburg. It's also a bit of a cold day. I think we're transitioning seasons from summer to an autumn, and it's a wonderful change of season here.
Mm-hmm. And what's the thing that's bringing you joy at the moment?
I think what brings me joy is not feeling exceptional with the polycrisis. Previously, we thought we were the center of the polycrisis, but just to know that the polycrisis has expanded and it's part of the global north and the global south, and there's a bigger collective amongst us, and that we are having this conversation, and I don't feel so alone anymore with the polycrisis. So
it's great to know that we're not in this alone. That does actually help, just like most kind of crises, individual or collective.
Well, welcome global north to the reality.
Yes, we need the help. Our third guest today is Dr. Katrin Hofer. She received her doctorate from the ETH Zurich in 2024. Congratulations again on completing that work. Building out a conceptual approach to participation, your empirical research engages with public participation in urban development. And a lot of your doctoral work, of course, included Johannesburg, South Africa. So we have a lot of common denominators here. Katrin, you also hold an MSc in urban development planning from the Bartlett Development Planning Unit at UCL, and you've engaged in applied research and development projects in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Katrin, are you also currently in Switzerland?
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm very happy to be here today. I'm joining from Bern, my hometown. So I'm currently in my apartment. I'm joining from here. Also quite sunny outside, which is nice.
Yeah, that's making us happy here in Switzerland to have a bit of sunshine. And what's something that is interesting to know about you that we wouldn't get from reading your online profile?
So I'm also a passionate dancer. For me, it's not salsa. For me, it's contemporary dance. But I'm also a passionate knitter. And so at the moment, I'm reading a book which is called The Power of Knitting, Stitching Together Our Lives in a Fractured World, has been quite inspiring.
There is something that's wonderful about this collective act of teaching each other knitting, I find as well. I've been meaning to join one of these, I don't know if we can say it on the podcast, but stitch and bitch kind of things for a really long time now. So maybe you can make a recommendation to me. It is important that we all have this kind of lonely hearts club of those dealing with the poly crisis and stick together to find these moments. So thanks for sharing in advance a little of yourselves. I think we all are required to do that in these times and find a common position. I think actually I'm the only one here who doesn't have an association at some point with UCL. UCL. Everyone's either working there or has had degrees from there. So that's we've got a lot of things in common. The interest in South Africa, the degrees and background. So we know a lot of the same urban conditions, which is also one of the reasons why I thought it would be so great for us to come together today and to introduce myself. I'm Lindsay Howe. I'm a professor of architecture and society at University of Liechtenstein. At least currently, I think by the time the podcast comes out, I will be assuming my new position at the Technical University of Munich as a professor of urban and spatial development, where I'm founding a research cluster about urbanization and peripheralization. So there'll be lots of work for us to continue discussing together. And thank you again all for being here today. So as we've said in our discussions, urban crises have been really intensifying globally in the last couple of years, even more markedly so since the 2020 pandemic, which is kind of a funny moment, because I think when it was unfolding, we didn't realize the long-term implications all of this would have for our lives and for urban life in cities. It's been dramatic changes we've seen in places like Johannesburg, where when I came before the pandemic and came back 4 years later after the pandemic, it felt completely different. And I think a lot of this has been experienced by all of us in our various locations where we live, also where we work, and in navigating the spaces between them. So this polycrisis really resonates throughout individual and through urban life. We see it in housing shortage policies. We have austerity policies. There's an alleged fraying of the social fabric. We have environmental damage, rising inequality across nations and generations. These are all really, really heavy and very macro scale kind of topics. But we also see this very much on the micro scale. So a lot of my work has involved this wild and crazy city that we call Johannesburg, and that's the lens through which I always read the world. And in contexts like South Africa, the challenges that we face there far outnumber the resources and capacities of the state, even if we have abundant academic and technical expertise and highly trained urban professionals. Instead of people being able to be meaningful and effectively deployed in South Africa, we often see that people are forced to take matters into their own hands, individuals on the ground, as well as planning professionals and design practitioners who have to cope with unpredictability and precarity of everyday urban life. Now, the four of us held a panel on the polycrisis back in December last year in 2024 as part of the series that I co-organized with the Urban Public's Zurich group, which was co-founded with professors Hannah Hildbrandt, David Kaufmann, and Philippe Koch. And it was evident then that all of us share a very deep concern for the places we work. We have a lot of ideas about the ways in which we hopefully can kind of radically reclaim some of these fraught spaces for people. And that was one reason why we thought it would be wonderful to come back together again today to share our thoughts on strategies and tactics for acting in the state of polycrisis we find ourselves in today. So I'd like to start from the African perspective. Thereshen, you've been practicing for more than 20 years now in various roles, and you've transitioned from kind of a classic design practitioner in a sense to doing more work in the economic development with the Sustainable Livelihoods Foundation. How does the polycrisis manifest in places like Johannesburg? Where would you say its origins lie?
It depends on the time scale. I mean, we can go back to 400 years ago as to where the big structural maneuvers played itself out. I don't know how productive it is to look at that long time scale because I think if we look at it at such a long time scale, it means that the adjustments will play itself out in a symmetrically equally long time. And I think that while it's been a long process of structural issues that have laid itself upon each other, I don't think we have the luxury to deal with it in this low incremental way necessarily. There needs to be something a little bit more urgent and as a response in that. So where it comes from, I think that we've got a long history of it. And I think that our the colonial project, as well as the post-apartheid project, as well as that set the terms of deep structural inequality within our societies that have transcended race to become something along class lines. And then there's the political elites. And it's just become really entrenched kinds of pathways on how people organize themselves and perpetuate the system of crises upon crises. And the sad thing is that while we can talk of crises the way we are, like it's a big hazard to many, I think the sad reality is that there's beneficiaries to the polycrises. And those beneficiaries have vested interests in keeping the polycrisis the polycrisis. And in sites like Johannesburg, you see quite clearly that there are actors that benefit from this, and they're very difficult to destabilize. So I think that it's what I'm sharing with you, there's a long history from it, but there's new emergent patterns of those who have adopted those systems for personal private gains to keep the system at place. And we do need to dismantle those systems now.
Mm-hmm. And the actors that benefit from these systems, where do they lie on the spectrum, for example, of inequality or income? Is it only sort of urban elites who are benefiting, or are there also people who are acting in their own ways in an insurgent way that are benefiting from the polycrisis?
I think it's across all orders of society. And in, across all orders of societies, you'll find between the political elite, the managerial classes, people eking out a living, there will be those power brokers who have eked out power and control within their particular tier and will find ways to disproportionately access control, power, resources in those spaces. And that's how it is, unfortunately. So I wish I could say that it's exclusive to particular class or social orders, but it's quite democratic throughout our social systems.
Mm-hmm. And you've been working now in various township contexts with this Township Economies project you've long been a part of, which is now, I think, coming to an end, at least for the time being, or has already wrapped, remembering correctly. Over this sort of, you know, about a decade of life, how would you say that these conditions have shifted? Has it always been this kind of way with interactions between power brokers and big men? Is it gotten worse with the polycrisis? Where have you seen moments where things have gone, have become more difficult maybe for ordinary people? And where do you see moments of hope in this, or positive urban experiences, moments of opportunity?
If I can just contextualize the need for the township, I mean, the township in South African context is a largely underregulated site where the majority lives, often creating increased vulnerability because of your how difficult it is to access opportunities and resources, right? It's a constructed geography in South African terms, typically where the majority black urban class live. Now, the interest in townships is that the townships was seen as a frontier territory because of the high levels of urbanization that was being manifest in those areas and how unregulated it was. And because of the unregulated nature of it, you were seeing impulses from various actors trying to meet basic needs, be it around recreation, economic livelihood, social livability. All of these things were coming out. And it created quite an acute and raw set of reactions. That reactions we wanted to understand. Now, and we feel that what you observe in those spaces can be applicable to other urban conditions within South Africa. So if you ask what we've seen as productive part in it, I think that we are seeing, unfortunately, a retreat from the state to meaningfully deliver on the developmental mandate it has within South Africa. It's not able to do it, not able to do it because of the technical capability, not unable to do it because of the scale of the problem, and in some cases also because of political will. And I think that what we're not able to do well is have robust institutions to hold these developmental efforts together. It's incredibly fractured, and we don't have that that ability to organize ourselves across various institutions, because the developmental project requires high levels of cooperation and coordination but multiple spheres of the state and the private sector. And unfortunately, while we have those in place, they're not able to organize themselves towards a particular goal and outcome. So what we're seeing is a erosion of what we think is public institutions. We think I'm seeing an increase in vulnerability, but I'm also seeing an increase in the agency of people. Now, the issue is with the increased agency, you can fall on either sides of legality. You can either become a criminal from your effort, or you could be someone of a maverick kind of innovator in those spaces. And depending on your policy framework, you will be either a criminal or a maverick within those spaces. And then it starts pointing to, do we have a progressive policy environment to absorb the micro efforts of the majority while we're trying to work something out? So it's a long-winded way of stating that.
Yeah. I think one example that I really appreciate out of that is this idea about the increase of vulnerability, but also agency and the policy surrounding it, is the example that you use about Evelyn Street, which is located in Namibia in Windhoek. And the fact that the policy shift allows people suddenly to be able to have these shebeens, these technically illegal drinking institutions, that it sparks a whole different kind of urban life. Can you say something to that?
That's right. That's right. So I think the point is there's a stalemate. The scale of the developmental effort needed is not possible within by letting the state drive that agenda entirely. The state needs to leverage private actors and its citizenry to co-produce this urban. The issue is that the state is a gatekeeper because it's a majority landowner and it wants to control things. And what's happening as a gatekeeper, if it doesn't happen on its terms and it's unregulatable and untaxable, it becomes something that's not endorsed by the state. And what it means that the actors of individuals very quickly become criminalized or not welcomed. And I think that the Evelyn Street example was a profound case study in demonstrating how the state could leverage the efforts of its citizenry in an incentivized way to produce a high street and create a really diverse nighttime economy in a township. And that was done with very little resources, but harnessing the kind of cultural impulses and the economic needs within a society and spatially targeting it around a high street. So that's just, there's a set of no-brainers in that example that's quite nice to look at, yeah.
That's something I've also found in my own work throughout South Africa, that this idea of being able to capitalize upon existing soft infrastructures and networks is an incredibly valuable principle that doesn't come naturally to designers and planners. It's something that you learn by speaking to people and doing qualitative research in a way. And so I'm curious, because the things that we find maybe in the context of the townships is possibly something different than what we would find in some of the areas you've been working, Katrin, which have been more sort of in middle or lower middle class neighborhoods in the inner city of Johannesburg. A particular focus of your research, Katrin, has been on public participation in urban development in Bram-Fisherville, which again, within sort of the greater regional fabric of Johannesburg and South Africa, is quite centrally located around Soweto. And you completed your PhD last year on this topic with David Kaufmann at the ETH Zurich. You've also been in and out of South Africa for decades, having lived in Pretoria. And I'm curious what your view is on all of this.
Yeah, I mean, my work very much speaks to what Theoris just has been explaining. As you said, my particular focus is looking at public participation. So I'm looking at the processes and how people are involved in decision-making in urban development. And I think here South Africa is a really interesting example because of its rather progressive policy framework. So with the transition to democracy, a lot of different frameworks for public participation have been set in place. And what we can see 30 years after is that the policy framework is strong. However, there are problems of implementation and there is a lot of frustration around public participation. And I would say this frustration is shared by state actors, but also by the people. And so my research specifically looks at how ordinary urban residents, so people who are not necessarily part of organized civil society, how they make sense of participation. So what do they expect? What do they understand as participation? And what we can see here is that both among state actors and also ordinary residents, there is this idea that public participation is important and that people should be involved in decisions that affect their lives. However, the way this is then implemented or framed really differs. So the state, as I said, it has a progressive policy framework. There are all these processes in place, and what they ultimately want is active citizens. However, they only want active citizens in the spaces that they provide. And I think that leads to a disjuncture between the way in which participation then unfolds. And I think this also leaves then space for all of these insurgent practices and so on. And so when talking to people about how they understand participation, for them, it's much more an ongoing process. It's a relationship that they have with the state. So it's an ongoing conversation. And so for people to conceptualize and how they would like to influence decisions and urban development in general, for them it's being part, an equal part of that relationship. People of Bram-Fisherville have been saying that, for example, they're only invited to have a say when the states want them to, but if they initiate a conversation, this conversation is blocked. And so they also use alternative means to get the attention from the state. And that can be violent, it can be protests, but it's the only spaces that they can actually use to kind of claim that relationship or to be part of a conversation. I would say there is consensus that people should be involved, but there is also a disconnect in how this actually happens and who has power to have a say in how this relationship is formed.
Mm-hmm. So have you also found that there tend to be kind of power brokers within these situations? And who are these people typically? Are they sort of state agents? Are they people that rise out of the community? How does that relationship function in the areas you've studied?
Yeah, I think, I mean, importantly, there are people in between that also help navigate these relationships. So in the context of Forum Fischerwald, it's local governance structures, it's street committees, it's block leaders. So it's often elected informal leaders in the community that then help facilitate that conversation with the state. But from other contexts, there can also be other power brokers. It can be institutions like the church, it can be violent gangs. So there are a variety of different actors that to some extent drive how crises unfold in these spaces, but on the other hand, are also steered by them. So it's really this relational aspect, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems like a key thing to keep in mind as we go forward with our discussions as well, how these things develop in a relational way. So Katrine, how would you define the urban poly crisis then from your perspective? If we can start to bring this together a little bit to put a bow on the South African input here and then transition towards Catalina, your experiences in Latin America. Drawing from your engagement in South Africa and beyond, obviously living here in Switzerland, you have perspectives that bridge a lot of these different contexts. How would you define the urban poly crisis?
I mean, to some extent, it's different crises unfolding simultaneously and also influencing each other. So it's different states of emergencies that are kind of happening at the same time and have an impact on people's lives. I would say now, drawing on my research in South Africa and Forum Fischerwald, I think, as you said, it's a rather centrally located area, but it's a low-income neighborhood, and people do experience intersecting forms of marginalization. So for them, this kind of polycrisis or simultaneous happening of emergency, I would say, is very prevalent. However, as I said before, in my research, I engage with how people make sense of what is happening around them. And I would be skeptical that they would use the term crisis, because for them, it's not a state of exception. For them, it's their everyday reality. So I think it's more of a perma-crisis because they don't know anything else. This is their reality. So in my own work, I don't actively use the concept of the urban polycrisis. But I think it is an interesting concept. And I think what I find important in my own work is to also look at the urban in the urban polycrisis. And so to think about what is particularly urban about this. And I think in my understanding, the urban is an arena where we have great complexity. So we have great densities. We have a lot of people living together. There is heterogeneity. And so it's also a political arena of where resources, opportunities, and so on are negotiated or problematized. And so thinking about the urban as this space of where these complexities come together, this has been really important in my work. And I think it also then, again, draws attention to kind of the governance and the politics of these spaces. Yeah, who are the actors? And like, as we've been saying before, I think, especially in the context like South Africa, I sometimes feel like there is an overprivileging of the state as an actor in governing these spaces. And so I think, yeah, for my work, it's important to also look at, I mean, if there is a retreat of the state that doesn't leave a void, there are other actors coming in. And so to think about kind of more from an urban governance perspective, who are then the actors that fill that void and how do they benefit from the crisis, or how are they also a victim of these processes?
Great. Thank you for that, Katrine. That gives us a lot of insight into the site. I'm wondering if anyone would like to respond to that. Thresh, if you have some thoughts from South Africa or maybe Catalina, then after that, how we can juxtapose that with your experiences in Latin America.
I would find helpful the contextualizing of the politics of public participation in a context of precariousness and vulnerability. So for example, Katrine, that the public participation mobilization that needs to happen is it's a big tax on particularly the poor, because I don't see the same kind of effort that is done by the middle classes or those who are more privileged. So somehow the public participation has become a necessity for those who are urban and poor and underrepresented, which kind of talks to how
poor those institutions are. They can't be heard. So in a funny way, I don't have to, as a middle-class person, have to spend my time with extensive public participation as a tax to my life, because there's things that's working for me. So somehow my voice has more agency, because there's a receptiveness within an institution. That's all skewed. I appreciate that. But it just, what is really difficult for me is how skewed the labor, right, of mobilizing and putting yourself together instead of dealing with things about finding economic employment or dealing with childcare or just doing normal life. And that's what I struggle with. And I think that in South Africa, the public participation is doing extraordinary work compared to what it used to do 30 years ago, whereas you're dealing with basic functions like water and electricity. I'm like, guys, that's not something that you need to mobilize public participation around. It's supposed to be the basic fundamentals of livability. And now you're finding that you need to mobilize people to do what the state should be doing as a basic framework. So for me, I think that because of the crisis, the public participation has descended to the lower rung of development and not dealing with more kind of emancipatory needs by the poor. So that's what I'm struggling with. It's been hijacked. And it means we're asking for basic things. Can I get a tap? And I'm like, we should be 50 years beyond needing a tap. So I just want to understand, Catherine, this is a really tongue-in-cheek response here, but I just wanted to know, what is this reading? And is there a way out, or is there something, are we descending? I just don't know where we are on the spectrum right now, because there's some parts of it that's quite concerning about who has to be involved in public participation, and it kind of becomes disturbing at some point.
Yeah, I mean, great questions. And I think it really kind of highlights the kind of ethical questions that we should be asking when thinking about participation. And I think one of the problems that we have with public participation policies, and that's not only in South Africa or the context of the Global South, I think that's something that we have to recognize across different geographies, is that this inherent assumption that there is one public, which is nowhere the case. So we have inequalities everywhere, and we always have gatekeepers, and we also have obstacles for people to access processes. There is this idea, or this kind of assumption linked to the concept of public participation, that if only we would give people the opportunity, they would want to be part of everything, which I think is also not true. And I completely agree with you. Like, we shouldn't be talking about a participatory process so that someone gets access to water. In the context of South Africa, all of these socioeconomic rights are in the constitution. The state has the responsibility to provide these services. And I think to then say public participation is the problem, why we don't have these infrastructures, is not doing justice. I think, to me, one way to think about these questions is to, there is some kind of unfair aspect of how public participation is talked about. And we always talk about formalized, institutionalized forms of public participation. So I think on the one hand, it's about broadening the concept or the definition of what public participation is. But I think it's also unfair in the sense that the state defines the terms of engagement. And I think that is something that should be challenged. So I think it's not only about co-producing outcomes, but also about co-producing processes. To have people, to give them a say in how this relationship unfolds and to be respected in these processes. And then I think it also just, again, I think in a context like South Africa, where there are so different realities within a very kind of small area, I think it's also important to realize that one national policy is not going to work for all the different realities that are prevalent in South Africa. And again, that's true to every context. So for higher income neighborhoods, as you say, I mean, they have the money and the power to get their basic services covered, to opt for different options, what works for them. So for them, there is a lot less at stake than there is for people who have less power or less socioeconomic resources. And so I think it's really important to think about the infrastructural preconditions that people have when engaging with the state.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to transition also to asking Catalina. I know that you've worked a lot with citizen groups, and perhaps that's part of these alternative processes that Katrin was just mentioning, that indeed we must question the way that the state decides from the top down to engage. And so these invited spaces that you've talked about, as it's been phrased by Mitrakab and other scholars, how does that work in your work?
Well, that's an interesting question, but perhaps I think I could like to connect back to what something that both Darish and Katrin mentioned in terms of how to even conceptualize polycrisis. For me, it's not a concept that I use, but I feel that, you know, it could be more accurate to think about civilizational crisis, which many kind of the colonialist scholars have used, because what we are witnessing in the planet at the moment is the complete, you know, failure of all the paradigms that have been governing, particularly also our cities and the way we in which we understand also city making processes, and also the agency or not that we have in that process. And I think coming from the Colombian context, you know, I think thinking about this temporality is essential, right? Because while some other contexts are thinking about, you know, when the state has been enacted and, you know, when the autonomy has been shaped, I think in the Latin American context, independence discussions have been, you know, already in a way gone, and we are in a different kind of wave of discussions. I think it's very important to point out that when we're talking about civilizational crisis in this case, manifests very concretely in everyday life, in the sense that has been violence kind of a common factor in every kind of shape or form, both in terms of understanding kind of the armed conflict, but also the structural violence that, you know, the cities of the urban majority has to face. And I think that has alter the relationship and even the ability or the trust that citizens have in the state when the state has been complicit in perpetrating crimes against its own citizens. You know, it kind of really upsets in a way the conditions of engagement. But at the same time, if I think in a kind of a very kind of important milestone in the Colombian history, in 1991, a new constitution was enacted as a response of a big crisis that was brought about because of narco trafficking and like a complete erosion kind of of the state in itself, but also a deep urban violent processes and a deep process that after some decades have been expelling peasants from their own places. So when you are seeing that the cities, that the result of that process, we are dealing with this kind of sedimentation process of cumulative reception of people that has been uprooted. And when you deal with forced displacement, the type of cities you get and kind of these requests of the basic infrastructural means, you know, completely changes even the assumptions or the expectations about the state, and pretty much goes back to what people can do together. And I think a lot of my work has been recognizing and precisely focusing on how collective action takes place and how solidarity kind of occurs in order to actually shape the city, because there won't be a savior. There won't be this precondition of thinking that the state will be there. And I think it's in that context that I've been privileged to work in the city of Medellin and for a very long time with a particular neighborhood, trying to even build a relationship that is not extractive, but that is based on epistemic justice, and trying to think also how universities and research have been part of the problem, right? And how even we depict, and what are the misrepresentations that we have done about city-making processes, and what voices count in doing, you know, in this process. And perhaps something that we've been kind of discovering together with the groups that we've been partnering is that we are always trying very attentive of the spaces of opportunity or the leverage that we can have when there are changes in political conditions, both at national and local level, and how, you know, we identify those cracks of opportunity, particularly now in the context of trying to implement a peace process and what is kind of how it lands in urban realities. And the work that we've been doing is trying to kind of advocate for understanding that neighborhood upgrading needs to be understood as a collective reparation process, right? Because we have a cumulative kind of series of violences and precarity that in the context of reconciliation, in a way, you need to bring the urban angle and the urban dimension, and particularly in the neighborhoods where most of the victims of conflict are living and have been enacted their own livelihoods.
Mm-hmm. Like, you said some really important things here that actually are relevant for both cases extending between South Africa and Colombia. We think about the time frame of when the new constitution was written and the independence movements. It's actually not a dissimilar time when there's been also levels of state coercion, a forced displacement of violence, direct and slow. Katrine, what would you respond to this?
I mean, I think it's really interesting to see the polycrisis as kind of shaping how these processes unfold, but then also leading to disruptures in various forms, but then to also think about the polycrisis as also a moment or an enabler of relationship building and alliances. And so I think that's really inspirational in the work that you're doing, Katarina, in terms of seeing it also as in a state of need, how solidarities can emerge among different groups and how this can be a driver for change in urban environments.
Mm-hmm. I also find it quite fascinating in your work, Catalina, how you've talked about aesthetics of compassion or territorial healing. Can you explain a little bit more about what this means to you in the context of the work you do with the citizen groups in Medellin?
Yeah, I think something crucial that I've been learning, particularly from these groups, and in conjunction with many kind of citizens groups across Latin American cities, is the idea that there's no separation between the body, the territory, and the planet. And if we take that into consideration, this continuum, then the relationship you get is completely different, right? And also, if we are dealing with, you know, people that has been subjected to a structural violence and all sorts of violences, the whole role of planners and city makers should be the enterprise of territorial healing. And territorial is a very important political kind of concept that is mobilized in the context of Latin America because it's much more than land, it's much more than a space, it's much more than city. Territory is a very loaded political, concept that allows people to coalesce and mobilize. Because what is at stake is, you know, is putting kind of their lives in the front line, but also the relationship, the attachment, and the belonging in a bigger picture. So what I've been kind of working with my colleagues and partners is trying to understand what from the micro, the methodologies, the ethics of engagement, we can start thinking together in kind of challenging kind of the Western paradigm and trying to think around how emotions specialize, how we change the practices, if we start thinking about the body, how body and territory is one and the same, and how can we see the city and our relation to neighborhoods if we start from mapping the body, for instance. So we've been exploring different methodologies, trying to think and reframe our approach through this idea of territorial healing. Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of body, territory, and planet being connected. That's such a powerful thing to express. Thresh, do you have any comments you'd like to make on this?
Yeah, I like those three tiers, right? And there's a little bit of sinisterness built into that, because the body and the planet has got very different terms of like ownership. You can't really own it. They have an ephemerality to it, so it moves on. And the planet can't be owned also, but yet territory can be owned and it can have a title deed to it. And therein lies the kind of evil that we can't dislocate. And I think that if we can rethink modalities of ownership and say that this is part of a collective effort that we need to work on, it's fine. But the territory between those two things, the fact that it's stuck in some notarial document, for me is a big problem. And I don't think we got new inventive ways of thinking about territory that corresponds with the kinds of ownerships, modalities of the body or the planet. So I don't know how we deal with that sticky one.
Like, we don't even have good methods for dealing with that within a township context of things that have kind of been formalized over time and been developed. I think that's a really interesting question when we talk about land ownership versus territory, because territory, of course, coming from Spanish and in the Latin American context, has a much different meaning than the way we might use it in South Africa, which is not a concept that's quite as prevalent in the English-speaking world. So I'm curious if either of you work with the concept of territory or in the ways in which you encounter that. It's more about, I'm seeing some shaking of heads here on the background of the Zoom call, is it? So it's more about land ownership, about different forms of tenure. I mean, at least in South Africa, for me, those are more the concepts with I've engaged.
So yeah, for me too. So I've been looking at different forms of tenure specifically, and also in how far this shapes how people see the state. So in my research, I engage with people who live in state-supported housing, which are known as RDP houses in the South African context, but also people of a very similar socioeconomic group who live in what is called backyard dwellings, which are additional housing structures on the plots of the RDP houses that are mostly rented out or inhabited by extended family. And to think about whether the fact that the state provided housing to some and not to others, whether that has an impact on how they want to engage with the state. So for me, it's more about the different types of tenure and state support that people have received rather than using the concept of territory. I haven't systematically looked at it, but I think one of the things that I found interesting also comparing the two contexts now, Switzerland and South Africa, is that I feel like a lot of the public participation in the context of South Africa, especially in underprivileged areas, is around claiming rights. Their infrastructural need mobilizes people to get active. In the context of Switzerland, it's much more, I don't want this development to be happening next to me. So I think to some extent, you could say that for lower income groups, it's about wanting progress. And in the higher income groups, it's about preventing development from happening. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic, like what mobilizes people. And I think for people who have something, it's a threat of losing it. Whereas for people who have not, it's the aspiration to get that. That's a very different motivation to be involved. And that asks for very different processes.
Complicit in all of that is the role of property. Like, if I own property, 100%. Where does that put me in my mobilization or my investment in it?
For example, I mean, when I was in South Africa, I was staying in Melville for some time of my field work. And I mean, there I was living with someone who was very active in their neighborhood groups to put up beams. So there is things happening, and they mobilize and they meet, because they want to keep everyone out. So there are these processes happening, but it's not asking for development.
But it's see what the responses are when people lose their water in Parkview. There's a public uproar in WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups. So people are.
I mean, if you look at the Eskom app and you have all these neighborhood, I mean, if you look what's written there from higher income neighborhoods, I mean, there is a lot of mobilizing around certain issues, but it's not productive.
But that's what I find also an interesting point when we, you know, go back to the idea of the urban polycrisis, that what we see a lot in Johannesburg, or what's really been visible to me over the past couple of years, is a lot of upper income groups getting completely off the grid. So they're not participating in the services anymore that are being provided and or paid for urban public life. So for example, if I speak to the family I usually stay with in Johannesburg, they don't draw their power at all from the Eskom network anymore, but they also can't really sell it back. I think that they still have massively high electricity costs because they're still being charged as some kind of substitute.
But isn't that reaction of finding more autonomy, just saying the example of electricity, as an inventive response, because you're trying to de-risk your environment from one of the crises that's playing out, which is irregular supply of power? So I in a funny way, and that's what's happening, is that everyone is acting in a lot more individualistic manner to say, hey, I'm only looking after my interests. So while there's a poly with the crisis, I think our reactions are quite individualistic amongst our particular tribes and interest groups. And that mobilization along those tribal or special interest groups are creating more fracturous kinds of urban settings. And it's based on class or the level of exposure you have to a crisis and how you respond. I do think that that is something to observe. I don't think it's, I can't judge whether it's productive or not. I think it's part of that systemic change. There's, people are reacting because you need to make a livelihood and get on with life. And I think that's just a reaction. That's how societies evolve. What I'm struggling with is that we're losing the net benefit of letting the state be a generator of or provider of the utilities, creating a big tax base and dealing with the developmental project. That's not happening. And you're going to find that there's going to be another way of organizing.
Right. I'm certain what happens when people opt out of their systems, and if the state then starts to lose even more power, if it can't deliver on the promises it's expected to fulfill. I mean, it's one thing to not deliver on planning promises, but not being able to deliver on the basic services, especially in South Africa, would be, it's a huge thing, right?
I mean, I think one way to think about this is also to bring in the concept of resilience. So, I mean, the higher income groups, they just have a different form of being resilient because they can opt out. So if the state doesn't provide the service that they want, they have enough resources to make it work for themselves. And the lower income groups, they don't have this option. They don't have these resources. So to some degree, they're less resilient in this regard. But then at the same time, and I think that's where the alliances and solidarity and so on comes in, because their form of resilience is their networks and the relationships that they have. And so collectively, I would say they are resilient. They have been for a long time. They've been living without infrastructure or state-provided services for a long time, and they found ways to deal with this. But it's a different form of resilience.
Certain words that didn't sit well, and I'm trying to figure out what doesn't sit well with me. And as you're talking, it's about that word hope. I'm struggling with it a little bit, because if I think about those who hope, what is their preconditions? And there's an association with helplessness, uncertainty, not knowing, desperation. And I don't want us to put ourselves in a position of hope where it's indeterminate and we don't know and we're going to have to make sense of whatever comes our way and it's up to chance. I think that the polycrisis is something that we can understand, we can name, we've got some technical and theoretical capability to name it. And I think we should use the tools we have to navigate through it. And I think because of the incredible ability to diagnose and know what the capabilities are in reading an environment, we should not be hoping necessarily, but to chart something with intent and deliberation and to test and to experiment and to try. So I just wanted to put something out there for us to talk about, because I think we've got more agency than the word would suggest. It is wild, it is overwhelming, but I think just having the convening capability here maybe puts hope somewhere else. If we're alone, we need to hope. But when we come together, I think we could chart and put something forward. So it's just as we're talking, because I just wanted to, I just registering, what do I feel like when we use the hope? And I don't want to hope.
Well, I guess technically we're supposed to design and plan, aren't we? And that's one of the competencies that we actually have. So it's true, in the coming together or convening. I just have the feeling a bit that I'd like to bring something optimistic somehow into this. As we talk about the polycrisis, we're not doom and gloom. We convene to exchange experiences and to try to find responses forward. So I like this idea of charting. I think that's a nice terminology to think about. Learning, mapping, taking in knowledge and finding in a pathway forwards with the individual hope and the collective optimism, maybe.
Yeah, and I do think that's what's happening. I think in our respective kinds of practices, we are able to see a set of reactions. And it'll be helpful for us to see what if those reactions are productive or unproductive. I can't say any reaction is inventive. Some of it's actually quite toxic and problematic and creating the systemic breakdown we're looking at. And some is amazing. And is it scalable? And can we name it? And what is it? And what is it doing? And who are the actors? And I think that, and can it be institutionalized in some way? I think we've got the literacy to do it, respective literacies. And I think it'll be nice to throw something down.
If some of that, Catalina, maybe ties into your kind of definition of the urban polycrisis or what that feels like to you from the perspective of your work, or speaking more broadly, sort of from a Latin American perspective.
So I think something that is essential in understanding the kind of the polycrisis is also understanding that it's a civilizational crisis and in a way is kind of a moment where we need to kind of really reconsider all the paradigms that we've been kind of assuming in a way. And I think some kind of key concept that I have found useful kind of to contest in a way the more, let's say, Western Orthodox paradigm of understanding how we go about dealing with inequalities, but also how we understand even our presence in a particular place, is this idea of this concept of territory, body, earth, and how, you know, it's hyphenated in a way, right? So to understand that as a continuum, because in Colombia, you know, you experience violence in many forms. And I think the first space where both, you know, violence and joy is expressed is in the body. And I think a lot of the conflict and kind of the bare violence has particularly been exerted in the bodies of women, of marginalized groups, that also happen to be kind of inhabiting in very fragile ecosystems. And therefore, kind of planetary extraction and kind of the what some have called the slow violence of environmental violence is completely intertwined with the subjugation and considering the body of women also as part of, you know, the frontiers of how even warfare is manifested. So I think having that as a background, it has also kind of put in crisis my perspective of how are we talking or understanding urban life, and particularly urban life in neighborhoods that has been self-built by many of those women that have survived and have arrived to cities and have built their neighborhoods with their own hands. And it's through kind of their labor and their collective efforts that actually my work kind of is even possible in order to kind of be able to, on the one hand, try to engage with the spaces that are self-built, but also in the ability to work in what I've been calling learning alliances with community leaders that are trying to protect life or create infrastructures of care and trying to build solidarity and respond to any wave of violence, most likely coming also from the state in the form or in the shape of evictions or authoritarian ideas around how self-built neighborhoods should be or shouldn't be in the map, or should be entitled or not to public investment, or should be labeled as a space of kind of risk, and therefore no public investment should be going there. So that has been a source of mobilization of many of the kind of movements and groups that find that type of state violence manifested in those decisions through planning, but also in the other kind of, let's say, shape of state violence in terms of militarization of spaces, or, you know, like very complicated and problematic ways to address public protest, mobilization, which again is all intertwined. And perhaps this is something that informs our understanding of polycrisis, right? Because all these kind of things and subjects and collectives are embedded in that type of, you know, entangled networks of different violences. From that perspective, also kind of the other layer is the presence of non-state armed actors, and how even though many people have been escaping from conflict in rural areas, and mostly in the 80s and 90s kind of went to the cities to find refuge, all the different groups and kind of dissidences and different alliances across criminal actors still find a very important manifestation, and most importantly, territorial kind of control and disputes in terms of the control of the territory with the state, but also with community. And I think that is kind of the other layer of how kind of violence permeates the life of self-built neighborhoods in many cases. And therefore, what you have as a result of all these kind of multiple layers and shapes of violence manifest in this multifaceted perspective of, you know, how harm and collective trauma is experienced in these places. And therefore, any
approximation to work in the in these places or the communities that live there need to be taken into account, all that context. And therefore, I've been very, you know, interested in creating different protocols to work, ethical protocols to work in there, kind of having long-term engagements in order to avoid this idea of parachuting or extractive nature of how kind of researchers often operate, but also have been prompted me to try to understand how in this kind of historical conjuncture, at least in the case of Colombia, when we are talking about peace and territorial peace, what is kind of the role of self-built neighborhoods in terms of how to build territorial peace? And therefore trying to connect visions of spatial violence with restorative or reparative violence and try to see what is kind of the spatial manifestation of this approach and how to bring kind of an urban lens to a discussion that oftentimes is just left to, let's say, to the political scientist or people that are more interested in security and defense, but doesn't kind of understand the space other than as an extension of warfare, but rather as an strategy of social transformation at the same time. So in my latest work with my colleagues, we've been trying to think of what does it mean territorial reparation and how collective reparation of the harm and the violence that most of the forcibly displaced communities that live in the neighborhoods that we've been working with can be addressed and what would be the key elements that we need kind of to understand in order to kind of think of an urban intervention in that realm. And that is why, you know, issues about creating methodologies that bring into account emotions and how that is embedded in a space is something that, you know, I've been interested in, but also trying to understand how can you bring a more, in a way, sacralized perspective of what is the relationship with communities that experience trauma. And therefore, how can we, as practitioners, also change a little bit our perspective in how can we collaborate and what are the other set of, let's say, spatial practitioners that can help us deal with very, you know, kind of painful experiences throughout life and avoid re-victimizing people that have been inhabiting and giving kind of their time, labor, effort to build better neighborhoods. So I could summarize it in there, and maybe we can carry on with the conversation. And perhaps I would be interested to hear also if Catherine or Tyrish have kind of any reaction, or if there's some resonance also with their practice. And perhaps with that, you know, we can carry on and think if my practice and my work can also help us to think differently about what is polycrisis, how it manifests, to what extent we have any agency over it, and what are some ways forward.
Yeah, I think that's interesting to bring up that you've mentioned both forms of acute violence as well as slow violence, which is something that we see through this Latin American context as well as in Southern Africa. And it has to do a little bit with colonial legacies and also everything that's happened since. So I would also be interested to hear how we then approach that, because all of us have a research practice in a way and also try to get action out of it through these kind of collective ideas. So I'm also interested to hear from everyone what the role of agency is here. So in these contexts where people are incredibly vulnerable and there's a certain ethics to engagement, as you mentioned, Catalina, how do we deal with that, with people that are living in very precarious circumstances, whose bodies have been victimized, who have these troubled traumatic histories? What does that mean for space and what does that mean for engagement?
Yeah, Catalina, I'm keen to see how we could learn from your particular embeddedment in a particular geography with a particular politics that's playing out. And I'm trying to work it back to a reality that we're working with in South Africa. I think that's the beauty of having this kind of conversation, right? And the thing that comes to my mind here is that in a context of violence, the actions that we need to be quite acute, the responses, as well as it's time sensitive. It means that if we delay on it, we're actually perpetuating violence. So the fact that, so what I'm getting to is that time does play a role in how that violence is experienced. So in this time sensitivity, we bring urgency into these sites. And there's a conundrum that I'm trying to work out here in our context, because when these sites that are incredibly volatile and violent that's playing itself out, it brings into question the new forms of ethics. Because if there's an ethics that is seen to be righteous, that righteousness and that level of inclusion, possibly participation and consensus, takes time. And I would like to know, how do these things sit in relation to each other? This thing about the necessity to do work very quickly, but trying to manage this ethics that often does not talk to nimbleness, agency, sharpness in the context of violence. So what I'm asking is, I'm asking for my own benefit, actually, is what are some of the more evolutionary and innovative ways of refining our ethics of working in sites of urgency and violence? And what have you come across? So what are the tensions? And from those tensions, hey, yes, here's an interesting way of thinking about how practitioners engage in these spaces.
I think at the heart of even how we conceive crisis is this idea of temporality, right? And in a way, the long durée of social processes. And I think, Lindsay, you mentioned kind of the colonial kind of perspective of it and how that manifests, even in the constitution of what we understand as a state and the role of a state nowadays, right? And who's in power in a way. And I think, you know, as researchers, sometimes we are the first ones of feeling also powerless in this context, because precisely of the urgency of action and the acute need to respond, and as not having all the tools, perhaps, or the resources, or even the degree of political influence that is needed. I haven't been able to be on the urgent thing, you know, we are going to fix the water, or we are going to be part of a collective, you know, let's say, quote unquote, solution to address flooding, which is what often times happen in many of the neighborhoods that I work with. And I think it just came to my mind one anecdote that while we were working during the pandemic, there was, of course, going on the pandemic. We kept working collectively with my students and the community leaders and kind of the representatives of the cultural center that we work with, that is partly covered or financed by the local state. And there was also at the same time the eruption of a national strike, right? Like the epitome of political discontent. That also started, let's say, in Chile with what it was called the estallido social, but also moved in a way quickly to Colombia, and in a way was a moment where nationwide there was a deep mobilization in many of the cities for several months, right? And we haven't experienced that many times, or only in the moments of complete acute kind of national crisis, if you will. So we had like an environment of where both planetary crisis from the pandemic, but also kind of national crisis of the national strike was occurring. And the neighborhood where we were working with, that is called Moravia, sits next to the main public university where most of the gatherings for the mobilization on the streets were happening. But at the same time, there's a presence of some militia or some kind of alliances with paramilitary groups. And I said, well, under these circumstances, what we need to do with our collaboration, our conversations that were at the moment talking about living heritage, you know, that was not the right moment to work together. And that perhaps we needed to just suspend that work because it was not urgent in the face of that acute violence, where our partners in the neighborhood were just hearing the bullets going on. The students and many of the people that were participating in these mobilizations were trying to find refuge within the neighborhood because they were being prosecuted by the police, but also at the same time by the militia, right? Like a very complicated picture when you think about, is there any kind of morale or interest to talk about living heritage, care, migration, memory, and how can we talk about recycling and ecological reparation in that context? I was very kind of worried and saying and expecting that people would say, no, of course, this is not the right time. It's not urgent. However, there was a complete, you know, backup of the process. And they said, this is our way to resist. We and our life and this collective work is what sustains us. And the fact that we're here working together is what also enables us to face these moments of complete kind of disorder. Because it's through these conversations that we also gain legitimacy as community leaders to work with the other members of the community and be able to negotiate with the non-state armed groups inside, but also with the local authorities in order to protect and preserve, you know, the life of people. So they found that by kind of working together, that was something that would help them. And it was urgent to be gathering and working together because of the urgency. You know, so I found that like a very kind of interesting example of how things that we could perceive that is irrelevant in moments of urgency, they are valued differently by partners that work in these conditions.
That also very resonates with the kind of experience that I have working in South Africa. So, I mean, I think if we see the crisis as entangled, we also have to realize that also kind of the answers or this ethic of addressing these questions is also a multi-layered concept or approach. And so I feel like the violence that people are experiencing in these spaces, it is material, but it is also social, it is physical, it is political. And so in terms of addressing or kind of thinking about how do we collaborate or how do we work in these spaces, I think it's really important to have that very context-sensitive understanding of the space, but also to allow people or the communities themselves to define what their urgency is. And I guess in many cases that is multifaceted. So it's not just material relief, even though that might be very urgent from kind of the outside perspective. But at the same time, because there is this long history of also political violence, I think there is a lot about recognition, about having a space to be heard, having this kind of communities and solidarity amongst each other. So sometimes even if we think, looking at this community, oh, it's very urgent that we address this material issue, the underlying issue might be something different, or it might be a complex kind of system of urgencies that they have. And they might not align with what we sometimes think needs to be done in these spaces.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, because at one of the previous Urban Public Zurich events that we held, we invited Ananya Roy to come to Zurich from UCLA and talk about her ongoing work there. And one of the questions that came from the audience is, do you consider yourself an activist? And what she said was actually, no, because I'm not putting my own body and my life on the line here. It's actually not my concerns. The best I can do is vocalize other people's concerns and do deep acts of listening to be able to unearth those things and try to bring them to people that are in power. I have safety and security as a person who's kind of in the ivory tower of academia. I am not actually putting my own self on the line here. She said that that's will always be a difference between someone who's taking a research or academic perspective or doing the actual work. I thought that was quite profound and sort of resonates with what I'm hearing from you across these various contexts as well.
Yeah, and I think that I'm interested in the from the institutions that we hold, be it academia, civil society, we come, and if these institutions holds a language of development and the ethics by default with that is at odds with the ethics and the language that happens on the ground in the context of urgency. And I just find there's a slippage, and we're misunderstanding, and we're not talking with the same kinds of metrics, words, frameworks, and it's accentuating the problem. And it means that if we can't calibrate our language, our levels of risk and exposure to the issues we talk about, it becomes problematic. So I'm just feeling sometimes as practitioners, how we work does not land well with the languages on the field. Now, in a practice sense, if I talk about where finance comes from, when finance comes to a field, it comes with terms and conditions. And those terms and conditions has a kind of ethics built into it around gender equity, sustainability, or whichever. And when you get into the field, it doesn't really work like that. So I'm finding it's interesting how we haven't evolved our ethics on it, and to distinguish between what is right and what is necessary. And I think when we think about what is necessary, it may mean that we may not do something that is seemingly right according to the codes from which we come from. I find that this, for me, is a thing to foreground and put onto the table and understand our limitations and say, this is what it is, you know? And then I think that we can start choreographing the responses to it. And sometimes I feel like sometimes practitioners, depending what the code or the language is, need to not be the first respondent to that site of violence. And I think if we don't choreograph the responses in a manner that corresponds with the languages of necessity, we can also complicate matters, you know? Now, the point that you talk about when some of these violences has a psychological and emotional bearing, that trauma processing sometimes takes place within a generation or intergenerational, and yet we need to do something now. And then I wonder about the real capacity of those victims to honestly articulate, mobilize, and do something. And I feel like it's a bit of a burden that those who have the narrowest window and perspective but hold all the trauma need to be making choices on stuff with grand perspective, you know? So I find that there's something that's quite interesting for me about the misfirings and misalignments often with how trauma plays out and what the instruments or apparatus is to respond to it.
I think I have two reactions to that. On the one hand, I think I completely agree in terms of, you know, like the vocabularies and the grammars that we use and what are kind of, you know, with the clashes and also the blind spots on it, right? And I think something that we found very interesting is that in that process that we were kind of addressing these issues and we were creating this atlas of living heritage, something that became part of the collective endeavor was creating a reparative glossary. Because the first thing that was kind of recognized and acknowledged by the community partners is that, you know, like the epistemic violence of the state and how, you know, is constructed this whole kind of territorial stigmatization and how they are referred to, what are the names and the labels used in the plans and the spatial plans in the public policy, right? So there was a very important kind of level on the discursive practices that needed to be addressed in order to bring, you know, possibilities to create any dialogue without feeling, you know, or expanding that kind of epistemic violence across actors. And so we engage in this very mundane but very productive way of saying, we've been called this way, but this is how we self-identify our work and ourselves, and therefore we would like to be kind of named in these ways. When you are using this word, this is what, you know, it causes on us, and therefore we really need to be thinking in something else. And as part of that, we also were finding different kind of methodologies of using, you know, like all the buzzwords that practitioners use, trying to work with pictograms in order to say, what do you understand from this? You know, why we cannot be taking for granted all these buzzwords and that they are going to be landing equally across different actors, because that, instead of helping us understand each other, are actually creating more division and more distance. So I think there's a real contribution that we can make in these microcosms of how can we kind of retool ourselves in order to create different dialogues. And that's why I've been obsessed with their use of storytelling and understanding storytelling kind of sort of a bridging perspective across urban knowledges, because that is something that has been kind of landing better. And in terms of how can we, you know, like how do we engage with perhaps the most vulnerable
groups and you know, the bearers of a lot of the traumas and how that is intergenerational for sure. I had to wait 30 plus years in order to be thinking about these things, because before there was not even the possibility to talk about peace or healing. So I feel that my own work and my own thinking has been evolving kind of with the needs of the country, right? I'm kind of a daughter of a moment of history in Colombia where the new constitution in 1991 was published, and when the role of planning and urbanism as part of the public function of the state was instituted. And therefore, I was the main kind of champion of creating a strategic spatial plans, to giving kind of the power to local governments and autonomy to define strategies to address spatial inequalities. 30 years down the line, I'm like, well, maybe we were just reproducing logics that didn't really understood the logics of informality. And maybe we were borrowing too many tools from the European perspective of what planning should be, and therefore what are the assumptions about the role of the state in a context where the state by no means play with those rules, right? So I've been also evolving myself in terms of, okay, maybe I'm not that loyal to that perspective anymore, and I'm just trying to see where are the hacks that we need to be creating, and perhaps issues around memory and places of memory, which you would think, again, that is not urgent, become something that is essential for victims of the conflict, because that kind of is like a real spaces that communities have created and they value, and is part of a reparative strategy of that political violence that they have endured. And therefore, what we're doing now is like, okay, how can we introduce that to the spatial system and create, you know, opportunities and languages, you know, vocabularies within the spatial planning system to bring and to connect with the practices and the interventions that people themselves have been doing for many decades, right? So are very micro interventions that don't go to the bigger scheme of things, but is also allowing us to work with collectives that have been embedded in this, you know, in these territories for over decades. And they've been creating capacity and knowledges, and people are much more qualified to be interlocutors of discussions around spatial planning. You haven't seen that before, right? So I think we are also in a different space and pretty much working in that symbolic kind of a sphere that I think is equally important than the material one. And I don't work with, you know, the hardcore infrastructure, because I think there's many people already doing that.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point to make about this sort of an intergenerational perspective and also an emotional perspective about these things. There's also an American activist named Adrienne Marie Brown who talks about pleasure activism and how you don't know you've won the struggle unless you can feel joy, and that pleasure is not a frivolous thing. It's actually a measure of freedom. So it's nice to think about that in a long-term perspective as well. So you have, you know, sort of the slow violence, like the structure of space and how we have to overcome that. And as you said, the understanding of different forms of city making, whether in maybe the Latin American context, we call it auto-construction, or maybe in South Africa, we would call it backyarding or informal settlements, these kind of practices of producing space by people and for people, and how finance comes into all of this, and where you get these kind of disjunctures between our expectations of what the state ought to be doing and what people are actually doing. And I'm wondering if maybe anyone wants to comment on the idea about care in this, because in a polycrisis, or it seems actually it's got a temporality, it's a long-term thing, but we have to act now. When that comes together with our expectations of the state, because we do hope that the state should take care of us in the polycrisis in a sense. How does that play out in our various contexts, this idea of, you know, not hard infrastructure, as you were saying, Catalina, but a softer sense of being cared for and being valued by and heard by the people who are supposed to be representing us?
Yeah, maybe I could just add a few points there, because, you know, going back to the temporality and what are the expectations we have with the state. Part of my experience of working, for instance, in Cali, that is a city that, unlike Medellin, doesn't have a trajectory kind of to have any progressive account or towards like informal settlements. You know, it took the whole team and my colleagues that have been embedded there for decades as well to make legalization possible, you know, to even address kind of the recognition of collective kind of ownership of land, or at least having their titles. It took, you know, a whole team very well kind of connected, aligned politically at that very moment, working in conjunction with the local state, just to get the type, you know, like the legalization of the neighborhoods. 4 years after many decades of, you know, preceding work, right? Like, how is that temporality working, and what is the role of, you know, of the state? So I feel that it's too slow for what we need, but at least, you know, when there's these windows of opportunity, we have kind of trying to take them and kind of to make them work at some point. But something that we are discussing, and I'm learning a lot of from the Latin American experience, and particularly in Colombia, is that part of starting talking about peace at kind of, let's say, national level, some cities like Bogota has been setting the lead in terms of thinking, you know, how can bring the local state to care, right? And can care be one, can be part of the urban policy? How can we understand care as part of an urban policy domain that goes beyond kind of the usual understanding of kind of the state as kind of the provider of services? And I think there has been some interesting debates, and I think Uruguay kind of set a very interesting example, Mexico now, Chile. They are talking about how can we address, you know, what are the material conditions and kind of what I have called the territorial circuits of care, understood and taken care of from the state perspective, but also what is the role of the national government in doing that. So in Colombia, a few months ago, it was also approved the national system of care, and understanding what is the role of collective care and what then therefore should be the role of state. Of course, there's a lot of disconnection and still frictions and there's still tensions in terms of, you know, to what extent is just a centralization of resources, or is oftentimes just emphasizing of the role of carers and then forgetting a more transgressive way of understanding care that goes, you know, beyond the gender perspective on it. And I think there has come up like very interesting things. If we bring a perspective of care, we also need to be changing the perspective of how we care kind of for the environment and the relation with nature. What is the role of the state in the redistribution of care, and how care has been disproportionately by women, and therefore like the time poverty that as a result of kind of the patriarchal system is part of the equation, and therefore time poverty is also part of the metrics that we need to be engaging and part of and engaging the state on it. So there's like a many fronts on that, but also, you know, like the spatial component of it, either in terms of repurposing existing public facilities and kind of trying to connect all the services of the state, in particular kind of vulnerable places, that is kind of a bit the approach that Bogota is leading, or what are the other strategies in terms of how do we deal with the public transit, or how can we kind of change the ethics and what some have called the feminization of politics. A lot of work to be done in that front, but it is a complete change of paradigm, and we are just starting to grasp with it, I feel, and even trying to think what is kind of the right terminology and what is the role of the state in places where this, we have a very complicated relationship with the state, and usually is aligned with violence rather than with care, if you will.
I find it interesting, this conversation, and also what we said before about the kind of the discursive practices really reminds me of Vanessa Watson's concept of conflicting rationalities and kind of this disconnect in the will to govern and the will to survive, and that both these logics have some underlying assumptions and that there is kind of a gap in translating this. And I feel like when we talk about care, I would argue that it's kind of similar, that there is a kind of a disconnect in how care is understood at the state level and kind of more from the bottom up. And I feel like in all of these questions, there is a lot of translation needed kind of to bridge these different approaches, because they both follow a logic, but these logics are not necessarily connected and built on each other. And so, yeah, I find this really interesting to kind of think about what is needed to make that translation work. And so, you know, like, for example, if we talk about care, there is care at the city level, but there is care in the household level. There is reproduction work that happens at the city level or the national level, or but also in the household. And these are all these different actions that follow a similar logic, but are somehow disconnected in terms of who's responsible for it and how is it recognized, how is it made visible, what are infrastructures of care within a household and then within the city. These are similar, but still distinct structures, and kind of thinking about to how do we work across these scales, I find really interesting.
Keen to just do a sense check about the nature of care and who are the kind of respondents to care, especially in the time sensitivity thing, and also what the mechanisms are of various actors. So I can imagine in immediate crises, the nimbleness of small actors to diagnose, localize themselves, and respond is incredibly profound. You'll see that adjustments and mobilization happen very quickly. And the state's quite absent in that. And I think I can understand partially why. I think the state is a slow machine. I think the state has been produced because of national consensus. And because of the scale of the state, and I think the way that it's fiscal arrangement works, it means that it's slow. And then that means for me that we start getting into two conditions of care. One is like fast care, which can happen at a local level, typically not by the state, but by other more sophisticated forms of governance and community structures. And the other one is this slow care, which is what I think the state is more comfortable with. And that slow care, I'm talking about, it's the underlying things about creating an economic environment for people to prosper, mobility systems, educational systems, healthcare facilities, that those are the things that create the conditions of resilience, that when communities go into a state of crisis, they can recover reasonably quickly. And I think that that is the things that the state is really good at. And I think that the macro investments over time, that's the stuff that the state should focus on to make sure that we've got quite robust infrastructures that when crises hit, and it's inevitable, that we have the ability to recover as quickly as we can. So in the absence of us not being able to deal with every crisis, what we can do is create a safety net of slow care that the state becomes responsible for. And I think that the more we can kind of arrange our actors to be calibrated to what their strengths are, the better it is. That's what I wonder about, because to think about getting the state to respond quickly, it's very difficult in the context of the global south, you know, where everything's in a crisis.
But then if we think about, what do we do to support households, for example, in an everyday crisis, for example, if they don't have access to water or electricity, which is something that's become increasingly prevalent. I mean, we've even had in Europe just recently, a few days ago, the loss of power and electricity in Portugal and Spain in ways of sort of like rolling blackouts, like we know from other contexts, right? So if we assume that the urban polycrisis is going to continue across all kinds of different geographical spaces and scales, if we have sort of a nice infrastructure set up for the slow care and the long-term care of places, how do we help people that are really urgently in need? What's the strategy there?
And just out of interest, I'd be keen to understand what we mean by crisis, right? There's an episodic thing when we have a power outage in Portugal and Spain. I don't know if that's a crisis. I could say that's a moment that of disruption. And then a crisis for me, I wonder about whether associated with crisis is shock. Or if one is in a perpetual state of precariousness, is that a crisis? Or has the urban system and its people calibrated to that already? I would like to understand what we mean by crisis, because I would argue that if this water scarcity plays out for generations in South Africa, I don't know if that still is deemed a crisis versus just a reality. And I think that part of the crisis, for me, part of the terminology of a crisis is this thing where it is perpetual and it is disruptive and it's cumulative in producing a context of precarity and unpredictability, and it has compounding effects. But then it becomes a point where it normalizes. And I'd love to know whether the definition of a crisis starts fading away. So I'm just curious on what we mean by that.
I think it might also differ when we're talking about to whom and for whom, right? So if there's a crisis, a water disruption, if you see that in a wealthy neighborhood, all hell breaks loose. If it's a water disruption in somewhere in Soweto, then we're not, I mean, then it's normalized. So I'm curious also how people would respond to that. So for which actors is what a crisis?
If we come back to what we've been discussing before, I would argue that there is not one definition of what a crisis is. There are different levels of urgency and different level of responses that are requested, that are needed because of all the different or the varieties that you were just talking about. I think in some regards, all of this could be called crisis, but none of it could be called crisis. And so, the question is whose definition matters? If communities feel like this is a crisis, I think that this matters.
Maybe going back to the idea about the language we use to engage with this and letting people identify it on their own and sort of being conduits in a way for voices, identifying their own challenges and needs. Is that the role of the role that we play here as researchers and in some cases practitioners?
Yeah, and maybe we also need to kind of be reminded of a lot of the kind of the critique around the use of crisis as a framework, right? And to what extent, you know, like even considering kind of the racial capitalist system and kind of the crisis prone and kind of the creative destruction approach is something that, you know, to what extent, as you have said, right, when crisis is used to create or enable regimes of exceptionality in order to further other agendas that were already in place there for a very long time, right? I think the risk is kind of equating urgency with crisis or thinking that crisis is just episodic and that there are not the structural components that were not already foreseen. And it's interesting that in our conversation, somehow it emerged a little bit that care has become a little bit of the antidote of that crisis. And I think that is one of the silver linings, if you will, of the pandemic, because before the pandemic, we wouldn't be talking about it that much, right? And it has been mushrooming in all spheres. And also when the authoritarian and kind of fascist moment that we're living in, I think a lot of us find a bit of refuge and, you know, some space for an opportunity space and sometimes an agency space or promise around that. And even if we are not very certain about many things, maybe that is kind of a space of where, you know, solidarity and care remains kind of cornerstones of how can we play a different role in the work we do individually or collectively. The polycrisis, I think, is just one way of articulating civilizational moment of, you know, that now it's clear that civilization is collapsing as we know it, that democracy as we know it is no longer there, that our relationship with the planet cannot keep going the way it is. You know, I feel that there's the collapse of many of the assumptions and even, you know, how the West giving the moral compass of the world that some had at some point, not me, of course. The curtains have been moved and revealed, and how that even the international order, you know, the international law, what is kind of the bare minimums for civilization is no longer there, and we cannot take for granted that is something that we share. And I think part of the bigger crisis, I guess, you know, in a planetary scale, is also how that order, quote unquote, is been also been put in jeopardy and is being, you know, confronted, and the hypocrisy that we are seeing and the colonial violence that is exerted is a very good reminder that this is just not a crisis. This is also something for us, perhaps one of the takeaways is that, you know, we really need to be critical about, you know, the vocabularies we're using, because in a way we can be perpetuating what we are actually trying to criticize.
Yeah, that's something that's also come out to me in hearing everyone from across these various geographical and political contexts, how actually the language that we use can either embed or contest deep-seated inequalities, which we have in all of these kind of contexts. But I think it's nice maybe if we're heading towards a conclusion here, if we can talk a little bit about how we would want to chart a path forwards out of this. So if we're talking about ideas, for example, about the body and territory and the planet, or about care, What are maybe each of you could just say, what's something that makes you feel joyful or hopeful out of your particular context? What's something that you think is a way that we can move forwards by learning from each other, for example? Why are we here having this conversation?
Difficult question. And the first thing that comes to mind is kind of a mic the moment. But I think what I find inspiring is if I engage with the communities and in these conversations and to clarify the terminology that we're using and some of the concept that come with these underlying assumptions, is that it is possible to bridge that gap. If we listen to each other, if there's a will to listen to each other and to learn from each other, there is a way to find a language or a way to unpack these assumptions and to find kind of a new way of conceptualizing, which I find inspiring. And I think so what we need as a way forward is really the will to listen to each other.
Yeah. No, as we wonder about this, I there's a part of me that wonders about the polycrisis and the stress we find ourselves in. And I ask myself, has it always been there? What makes it so special now in this historical moment? And I feel like, what if the crisis has always been there? And what if the only reason that it's surfacing is because our diagnostics has gotten so much better? Because our world has become so much more connected and interdependent that we can feel the tremors from faraway geographies in a very tangible way. And I also wonder about the role that European institutions and diagnostics is able now to come back into these forgotten territories and report back and shape its funding and its academia to talk back to it, because this wasn't here 60 years ago. So I do wonder about where we find ourselves in our historical moment and wonder, like, really, like, what is this crisis and what has always been here and what hasn't been here? So I'm finding what's helpful is that I do not have a response, Lindsay, to your question, because I think I need to think about it for a little bit. It's a lot, and I don't think I'll do justice in reacting to it right now. But what I find incredibly helpful is a space to come together as a community to understand our limits, our vocabularies, our experiences, and to table them together and come out of it a little bit sharper, with both a little bit of humility, but also a much more refined way on how to talk back to the crises within our particular local environments. So I'm finding it in a selfish way quite productive for me, and I hope by default for the context within which I work.
Yeah, I could resonate with that as well. I think something that in a way is a space of resistance or re-existence, as some Latin American scholars would call it, is that we need also to slow down, because I think part of the strategy of the moment is thinking that, you know, everything needs to be happening now and there are 10,000 things at the same time. Everything is entangled, and I think I find that paralyzing. And then the thing that perhaps, you know, in a way the corporate university is not allowing us to do, you know, or is extending that logic, is actually having these spaces of the thinking together and how we're crafting the togetherness in order to see connections, similarities, interdependence across contexts. I'm like a big fan of learning from different places, and kind of the translocal solidarities that can be enacted in doing so, because I find more parallel strands between South Africa and Colombia than any other discussion in terms of what is going on perhaps here in the UK, right? Because of, you know, very twisted, similar, but yet different genealogies. And I wish we could have more spaces actually for thinking together around it, beyond the policy mobility approach, right? That gives you some tools, but perhaps we are going in a more also, you know, deeper way in terms of thinking of the whys and the how we position ourselves, but also how can we streamline our vocabulary, our analytics, and therefore our ability to work together towards, you know, finding different strategies of engagement and perhaps addressing those pressing needs. So sometimes the language of urgency can also, you know, jeopardize our ability not to feel guilty, to take it slow and actually think together slowly in how can we sharpen our ideas and our tools. That's why I've been very obsessed with the methodologies, right? Like the how to, not only with who, but also the how to, because in the how, I think we still have a lot of leverage and a lot of space and agency. Perhaps I don't have any access to other spaces of power, but there, that is my space for making change. And perhaps, you know, as someone said, you know, like the role of art, it is making revolution inevitable. Somehow I feel that, you know, in this case, when I'm engaging in my pedagogical practice, you know, I'm just trying to get excited and inspire these new generations of practitioners of doing and understanding things differently. And that is what, in a way, gives me, you know, some perspective and sense of joy as well.
That reminds me a little bit of what Achille Mbembe talks about with this will to community that actually is the decolonial moment. So being able to join our joys and struggles together and try to find the ways that by doing so, we can identify pathways forward that we wouldn't have been able to identify in isolation. I find that a very powerful concept. You know, that in a sense, all of us here are longing for some sort of justice and some sort of care to be seen across different scales for our own lives, our bodies, our communities, our planets, and to be able to do right by the world despite these conditions, which whether we can go back and forth in a longer discussion some other time, the nature of the polycrisis and the normalization of it. I think these are all wonderful open questions to continue thinking through. But the idea of being able to join together in the struggle is the oldest concept on the planet in a sense, but one that we still very much urgently need. So I so appreciate everyone being here to have this conversation and to see what might happen if we can join these moments together. So we've heard a lot today about working across a wide range of urban conditions, each with its own unique challenges and potentials. So as our crises are likely to continue to increase in the future, it will remain important for all of us, for scholars, activists, and anyone involved in the creation and maintenance of our built environment to enable these kind of complex public conversations. Every urban place has its own unique problematique and iterations of the phenomena that we've been speaking about today. So all of us would like to encourage everyone listening to go out, find your own crisis, and get involved in identifying the solutions. So thank you very much to all of our guests for being here today to speak with us. And thank you to you, our listeners, for giving us your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.